Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to another exciting edition of the Pointless Exercise podcast. The baseball playoffs are in full swing, and so joining me to talk about them is baseball big brain, David Brown. David, how are you?
Hi, Andy. I'm enjoying the contests so far, hoping, like you, that we'll get a little bit of an extended series here. It's not looking great, but we'll see.
I want to clarify, when I said big brain, I didn't want to intimate that you have encephalitis. I didn't mean that your brain is physically bigger than it should be, simply has a lot of thoughts in there.
Well, as they say in the commercials, if you have encephalitis, tell your doctor.
So because we haven't done this, we did it right before the wild card started. I wanted to talk about the thing that everybody was kicking around, this whole idea that does the wild card round actually give an advantage in the division series to the wild card teams because they don't have to deal with the dreaded 5-day layoff?
Well, I guess the answer is yes, unless it doesn't. It all depends on circumstances. I don't think I'm just thinking of the Phillies here. It was brought up a lot in the Phillies Braves series. You know, the Phillies kind of had to piece together their pitching rotation, and they were, you know, they faced a fully arrested Spencer Strider twice, and you would think that those would be, big advantages for the Braves, and it wasn't really. So, you know, if you look at the history here of teams with layoffs, you know, sometimes it didn't matter last year when the Astros won the World Series. They had all kinds of rest and they performed fine. So I think, you know, on a case-by-case basis, yeah, there can be some rust, but I don't even know if that lasts more than an inning or two. And it is kind of silly to think that the Phillies had any kind of, you know, advantage from it. I think, maybe the Braves got a little complacent, but I remember people complaining about how their offense wasn't clicking before the playoffs started. It wasn't, a great, huge scoring machine toward the end of the regular season. So, and that just kind of continued. So I don't think there's any real linkage there, you know, any kind of science or even reason that can say with a fact that the wild card teams had some kind of advantage. I think they usually don't.
To me, it seemed like the disadvantage for the Dodgers and to the same, but to a lesser extent, to the Braves, was that they both had key pitchers who were hurt. Like the Dodgers, yeah. Everybody. Like, you know, they trotting Clayton Kershaw out to start game one. I don't think they expected him to give up 6 runs in the first inning. But with a fully functional starting rotation, he is not their game one starter anymore.
Right.
And I also like that the Brave, who was the most vocal in his disagreement that the layoff meant anything, was Spencer Strider. He's like, no. He said, I was rested, pitching on normal rest, and you know, they just beat me. We kind of identified that as an issue coming into it, that for as good as those two National League teams were, they both were kind of ripe for an upset simply because of the state of their pitching. The Braves seemed like they would just pound their way through it, right? Like, that offense was so good, they'll just make up for it. the Dodgers never really had a chance, right? Like in the first those first two games, they're way behind before they take their first at bat, and it screws everything up for the rest of the time. And then
on top of it, Mookie and Freddie, they got him out.
Yeah. And then there was also the idea that if the Phillies could get the Braves where they only had to beat them three times, that made them more dangerous. And it all played out that way. But you're right. The Astros didn't have any problem with it last year. They didn't have any problem with it this year. And somebody had the stat that since this started, teams with the layoff are 24-14. So, I mean, even though it's, you know, we've seen what we consider big upsets, for overall, there is an advantage still to in the playoffs, the fewer games you have to win, the better. And, you know, these teams have an opportunity then to get rested, to get their pitching in order. The problem with, especially with the Dodgers, was it didn't matter what order they put the pitchers in. They had lost too many key guys. And then you were talking about how the Braves weren't hitting on all cylinders. It's probably because they had the unfortunate circumstance of in the second to last week, they got to take batting practice against the Cubs for 3 days and then couldn't adjust to real pitching after that.
You're kind of joking, sort of. But there is something to that. I haven't really looked up to see. Long story short, you know, winning 100 games in the regular season is a great accomplishment, but it can be misleading in a couple of ways. I mean, there's some really bad and mediocre teams. You know, you can pad your record and kick the crud out of a whole bunch of teams that aren't relevant when it comes to the playoffs. And the playoffs are just a little bit of a different animal. Baseball fans know or should know. Sometimes they forget. It's a game of matchups. It's a game of timing. You know, we already talked about the timing of the Dodgers not having because of injuries and lawsuits all of their pitchers, and you can kind of go into the playoffs with a misleading front on there. You know, look out for this 100-win team, but you know how much of that is beating up the lower half of the league and when the matchups are right and the timing is right and other things, you know, there is a bit of randomness to it, but it isn't so much that anything can happen on a given day. It's that, if you catch a team at the right time, you know, you're going to be better than them. And if you look at Philadelphia, I think you can objectively make an argument to say, well, they're still the best team, even though they didn't win 100 games.
Yeah.
So this shouldn't be that much of a surprise. I think the media always gets caught up in whatever's happening in front of its face. And, I've been a little bit surprised at the volume and the amount of, we got to change the format. And as far as I'm concerned, you can keep tweaking the format. It's fine. It's not that important. You know, I still think, it would be ideal to not have as much of a layoff. But still, you know, then you're also trading not having to win a round of the playoffs. I mean, that's a big break for the Braves and the Dodgers, and they didn't take advantage of it. They didn't have to get through the weirdness of an entire round of playoffs, and you know, they trade that for some extra rest, which might or might not be helpful. So, you know, there isn't a solution here. You know, this is a solution in search of a problem or whatever. Right. It's not going to be any better the next thing they try. But if they want to keep tweaking with it, whatever.
Yeah, and the Dodgers and Braves didn't lose to bad teams. In fact, the Phillies they did it the second year in a row where they kind of punt the first 60 games. And then they play like a bat out of hell for the last 100, where they had they played on a 100-win pace for the last 100 games, which I don't think means they went 100. No, I don't think that's how pace works.
Right.
But they were they might very well have been the second best team in the National League from game 62 to the end of the season.
Yeah.
And then the Diamondbacks were in first place for a big chunk of the first half before they went on that ridiculous free fall, and then they got out of that. So, you know, I think there's probably something also to be said for they're playing division rivals in those. Two teams are very familiar with, not terribly intimidated by, and they just outplayed them.
And similar kind of stories in the other side of the league. You know, Houston was kind of – they weren't terrible, but they obviously weren't at their best in the first half of the season. They got on a roll. And the Rangers have been at various times – like clearly the best team in the American League, and maybe just a shade below the Braves and the Dodgers overall. Same kind of thing. The Phillies, they didn't have, I don't remember for how long, but they didn't have Bryce Harper for most of the first half. And then even when he came back at first, he wasn't hitting home runs. He went on some kind of terrible, and I know cause he was on my fantasy team. He wasn't hitting home runs until August. So, you know, they weren't, you know, he's their best player, and they didn't have him basically until the last 2 months or so, 6 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, even though he was physically there, Trey Turner wasn't any good until August 1st. He got a standing ovation at home, and he just took off.
The reverse psychology.
Yeah. Another topic that was beaten into the ground was the oh-so-controversial Orlando Arcia locker room. Things I scream out loud in the locker room in the presence of the media are clearly off the record, especially the profane rantings of Attaboy Harper. Couldn't believe that got repeated, and it was all mad at the reporter who said him, and then very strangely, Alana Rizzo went on her, I don't know if she's on every day or just weekly on the Chris Russo's little shout show on MLB Network. And she was just all over, referring to the guy as a blogger, and it was like she was trying to take the state of sports writing back a decade.
Right.
The reason it became a thing was that Bryce Harper hit two home runs and stared at Orlando Arcia both times. The only thing that was different when that got passed on to him was that he stared at Orlando Arcia. I have a feeling he still would have hit the same two home runs. I don't think it was the extra motivation that Bryce Harper needed. But just the fact that that was a discussion. Maybe that was a product of the division series all kind of ending quickly and with a thud. That instead of a lot of interesting on-field stuff, it's like, well, here's something we can all shout at each other about for a while.
Yeah, let's gravitate to this. Yeah, I think your point is right about how there wasn't a whole lot that was interesting until then, and then you know, I wasn't there. I'm not like Murph, you know, where I've never been in a clubhouse. I have been in a few clubhouses, but I wasn't in this particular one. But it's my suspicion that Arcia knew what he was doing and did that on purpose so it would get back to Harper, because he was feeling, you know, he was feeling himself a little bit, and then probably immediately regretted, oh, crap, what did I do? Because those guys know he's been around for a long time, Arcia. It's not his first year. You know, he uses an interpreter when he does interviews, but he speaks and understands English. Attaboy Harper is in English. That is not Spanish. So that's an American idiom. And so I suspect that was kind of a harebrained moment of jubilation or whatever, trash talking on his part. And I'm sure he regrets it. But like you said, you know, Harper is probably going to hit those home runs anyway. It's more about what goes on. And that all the other stuff is theater, pretty much. And so, you know, I don't think the report, and it was more than one reporter. It was Jake Mintz, who's the Suspettus Barbecue, half of that team. So he's a little irreverent, but he's a reporter, a journalist-ish. And the other person who reported it was Chelsea Janes, who works for the Washington Post. So, that was all fair game, and I also suspect said purposely so they would hear it. It's not something you're going to say in an interview or attribute your name to it, but that's something that, you know, hey, if I shout this loud enough, Harper will hear. And then afterward, they regretted it. Yeah. So I think that's what was happening there.
Yeah, I mean, they're both in the Baseball Writers Association of America. So we then had to issue a statement to basically say, you know, we stand behind these two and what they did is fine. And I guess the difference was she didn't see who yelled it, so she reported it without attribution, and he saw who yelled it, so he said, hey, it was Orlando.
She got it on tape. Yeah. She was interviewing somebody else, and it was like ambient noise or whatever, and it, you know.
Yeah. It's such a weird thing to yell, too. And that was it. I didn't overshadow it. It was the byproduct of an incredible ending to that game, where Austin Riley had hit the one-handed two-run homer to give the Braves the lead, and then it looked like the Braves were going to give it right back. But Michael Harris, II, smashed into the fence and made an incredible catch. And then the Harper had, you know, he's his own third base coach, and he should be. He's a good base runner. And he looked at it and said, well, he's not catching that. And he was going to score a tie the game and then realize, oh, shit, he did. And then it took Riley being in the right spot at the exact right time to make that throw. And they barely got him anyway. So I don't even know that it was that bad of base running. It was just two great plays by the Braves.
I think he probably could – Harper could have gotten – you said he's his own third base coach, and that's funny because he was – earlier in the series, he ignored Dusty Wathan, you know, and was safe pretty
easily,
safely at home. But he ran through a stop sign and said that he didn't see him. So he kind of, you know, Harper definitely, what's a nice way to put this? You know, he thinks he's the smartest player on the field. Yeah. And I don't know that that's in a bad way, but he gets himself into trouble potentially a little bit for being a little too adventurous. I think he could have, like, stopped at second and still scored.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you're – that's easier for us to say when we're watching from home or in the press box or whatever. When you're on the field on second base, I totally understand why he did what he did. You know, that the play that Austin Riley made was probably the best defensive play of the playoffs. And maybe of the season. It was like Jeter getting the ball and doing the relay against Giambi in Oakland, but better. And it was it saved the day for sure. I mean, we're not talking about this in the same way if Riley doesn't make an extraordinary play on defense to save the cutoff throw and then get Jeter and get Harper.
Yeah, it's one of those where, you know, it's right place at the right time, but it's also not just standing around, right? Like, what else?
Yeah.
Riley has nothing else to do on that play. You know, once Harper is running away from third base, but get himself in a spot where he can help out. And he did.
For all you little leaguers out there, that's right. Why you always keep moving on the play. There's always somewhere for you to run.
Yeah.
I mean, that's we joke about that, but that's – there you go. That's it's a good teaching moment. I'm going to remember that if I'm coaching baseball again this spring for my son.
Yeah. Also, a moment I really enjoyed in that, or it's a series of moments I enjoyed in that series, was Rob Thompson, but not that Rob Thompson, who manages the Phillies for real now, not just on an interim basis like he did last year. Going to his two end-of-the-game relievers in the sixth and seventh because that's when he needed them. You know, there was a threat the first time, I think, when Kimbrel came in. And he's like, we can lose the game right here. Saving him for the ninth isn't going to do us any good. And the same with Alvarado. Maybe it was opposite. But you just don't see managers do that. They all talk about it. They all talk about, oh, I'd be willing to use my that guy at any point. But when they do, it's kind of the Joe Maddon, bring Aroldis in and go, all right, buddy, and see if you can get us 9 outs. Not with the plan that you're going to pitch your normal amount, but you're going to pitch it right now, and we'll figure out the end at the end.
Bochy better not try that this year, I'll tell you what. Yes, it's there have been other examples of kind of the super analytics moments where they bring him into high leverage, but that was real early. It was totally the right thing to do, and I don't know how many other managers do that. You know, I don't. It's almost like they bring him in. Everything worked out because sometimes you'll see it in the eighth inning. You'll see it in the eighth inning a lot, where not a lot, but more, where they'll bring in the really good closer type for the meat of the order. And it's kind of a just in case. It all kind of worked out where there was sort of an emergency situation and he had the best relievers, you know, going. And it was, you know, it's hard to know when to do that because you still have to get a whole bunch more outs. And I mean, it was kind of touch and go there for the Phillies in the last couple innings. It was like, you know, were they, it wasn't so much that, you know, was he premature, but, you know, do they have enough relievers to finish this game? And I think some people were thinking they'd bring in Orion Kirkering to finish it off, but I guess he's been a little too unstable. But the Phillies still had enough decent relievers to get out of the jam. It was kind of a perfect storm, and I don't know if we're going to see that again in the playoffs. It just kind of all kind of came together there, and it was kind of a fun moment where you bring in your high leverage guys and in an emergency situation, and they get out of it.
Well, it's funny. I think everybody thought when they used Alvarado and Kimbrel in the sixth and seventh that they would finish with some kind of combination of Kirkering and Hoffman. They didn't use either guy.
Yeah.
They got the six outs without having to go to either one of them, which is always too bad because whenever Orion Kirkering pitches, then TBS just shoves a camera right up his dad's nose. Very, very marquee sports network style. Here's his dad. Thanks. Why are we watching this? Because he cried the first time. He's not crying again. The kid already made his big league debut. Dad is done crying. You can stop trying to show him. When we were talking about the Harper thing, it was really strange to me then. It was vaguely similar, somewhat similar. In the ALCS, when Jose Altuve did not retouch second base, and it was so weird because he was right there. He like stepped right next to it, and it's like he knows the rule. I wonder if he just stepped and missed it and said screw it and just kept running. But everything looked odd. In fact, when they first challenged it, I thought there's no way he didn't touch the base. He was all over. He was basically running circles around the base, and he didn't. He touched it going past, but didn't. He stepped right next to it with both feet.
Right.
Going back in the other direction.
It's a hard thing to, it's sort of like, you know, getting back to the Harper base running blunder. You know, what should he have done? You know, when you're in the moment like that, even like super professional athletes kind of lose themselves, and you're sort of afraid to look around for the base because then I don't know if you think you're going to get your legs tied up or you're going to get even more confused. But it's funny that how often you'll see guys not even look, and sometimes they touch the base and sometimes they don't, but they don't even look to see where they are. It's almost like, well, if I can't trust my instincts or whatever, I'm not going to do it. And Altuve, though, you know, it's kind of an iffy. He's had some weird base running too. Not so much out of aggression, but he's lost himself a little bit before in the bases. Got a reputation for that. So maybe he and Harper are similar in that way. But it is funny how all the training these guys go through and the big moments. I mean, how many big moments is Jose Altuve been in, and you know they still screw up sometimes.
Wasn't it? It was either Lonnie Smith or Vince Coleman. One of them ran straight across the infield one time. Do you remember that? They clearly didn't know the rule, and just they had rounded second, and the ball got caught, and they just took. They just ran a straight line back to first base. Not bothering with second base at all.
T-ball game or whatever. Yeah.
And it's like, really, how long have you played baseball? This has never happened to you before, ever, right? Or you've never seen it. It's like, nope, I'll run wherever the hell I want. Yeah, it doesn't work that way. So a guy that I was, I mean, how can you not be impressed by? Precocious. He's more than a rookie because he didn't come up until really late in the season, but Evan Carter of the Rangers.
Yeah.
He came up because Adolis Garcia smashed into the wall, right, and sprained his ankle, and they thought he was going to be out longer than he was. So, like, fine, we'll just bring this kid up. And then Boch got a look at him, and they never let him go back to the point where he's just like, you know, I know this is a tough left field to play here in Houston. You've never played here, but tough. You're going to learn it. And he made right. an incredible catch. Yeah. I don't know what else I was going to say other than he's really good.
It's I mean, he's – and it's funny, too, how they always make a big deal about how his nickname is Full Count. And the minor – I think – is it Full Count? Is that it? 3-2 pitch? Something like that. And it's like – because every time he gets the 3-2 and then it happens, you know. And they go, oh, he did it again. But, I mean, he's just – yeah. And it's – I think he's an example of a guy. The Rangers sort of had as good as their offense and as, you know, as much as they had going for them all season, they kind of always were missing a guy. You know, it was usually like a DH. That's why we saw so much of Robbie Grossman.
Yeah.
Is it Robbie Grossman?
It's Robbie Grossman. In fact, they were like, yes. There is no weak link in this Rangers lineup. And I'm like, Robbie Grossman's batting third. I think there's a big third. Weak link. And I don't know why Bruce Bochy is batting that weak link third, but he is.
It worked out. Maybe it was like a cry for help. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe it was, I'm going to bat this dud third until you give me an
Chris
actual
Young,
third
hitter. Chris Young, hey, yep. Look who's hitting third. You see what I'm saying here? But he's, Evan Carter has been, sets a great example at the plate, you know, makes the pitcher work, draws a lot of walks, and gets hits, makes those plays in left field. And it's like good for the Rangers for bringing him up and developing this guy. But, you know, where was he in June? You know, that he probably should have been here all along. So I guess we can criticize, too. But
think of all the service time they saved.
Yeah, right. I mean, the
best
Rangers,
of both worlds.
$500 million in payroll, are going to worry about, you know, Evan Carter is going to, he's not really the kind of guy that is going to go out and break the bank when he becomes a free agent. As good as he is, I mean, you know, we're not talking about Aaron Judge, I don't think. Maybe I'm misjudging him, but selling him short, but yeah.
Well, I mean, it could be, I always think whenever this happens, it doesn't happen that often, but you get all of a sudden a rookie who kind of shows up late in the season, touted or otherwise. I always think back to Greg Jeffries in the 88 Mets.
Yeah.
Where he showed up and he was amazing for them. You know, for a really good team, and all of a sudden he's the only guy that could hit in the playoffs against the Dodgers.
Right.
In fact, he'd been impressive at the end of the season to the point where some guys voted for him for Rookie of the Year when he was going to be eligible for Rookie of the Year the next year. They're like, can you win it twice?
Yeah.
And that was as good as it ever got for Greg. Like, he was a solid player for years, but he was never the star everybody thought. But you add, based on that short sample size in the playoffs, you thought, man, this dude, you know, he's going to be an all-star 15 times.
That's actually a really good question. Can you win Rookie of the Year twice? I mean, it would seem like the answer is no, and there might be something in the rules that say you can't, but you certainly can be voted on more than once, because Randy Arozarena, it was like three times.
Yeah, three-time Rookie of the Year vote-getter, Randy Arozarena. You mean he got three votes? Yeah. No, three different years. Like, he was the Susan Lucci of Rookie of the Year. That was like my old favorite stat about Ken Griffey Jr. Was he did not win Rookie of the Year, but he was younger than the guy who won the American League Rookie of the Year his first 8 seasons. And part of that was because they had a couple of they had Bob Hamlin and Marty Cordova, who were old winners. But it was amazing. It wasn't until he was 27 years old that somebody finally won the Rookie of the Year and was younger than Junior. It was amazing. I had to put him in the Hall of Fame just for that. even if he did nothing else. So a lot of people.
Go ahead. Kind of a left turn here, but you excited to see Ken Griffey acting again in Geico commercials? He's with Mrs. Griffey.
Yeah, the two things about that commercial, the one they're both in is the one where the umpire moves in next door. Number one, why is the umpire kicking leaves on Ken? That seems like the backwards, right?
Right.
Like the umpire should be getting kick things on, not on.
Right.
And the only part of the commercial that I genuinely enjoy is when she gets thrown out. She like Ken has to grab her because she's going to go after the ump. I really like that. Yeah, it is nice to see. You know, we were juniorless for quite a while, and then you know, he showed up and he was the hitting coach for the great World Baseball Classic team, and now he's everywhere again.
He's getting back into it.
So a lot is being made of the home field advantage that the Phillies have, in that their crowd basically goes nuts from an hour before the game until an hour after the game. They don't sit down. They chant now like they're a soccer team. They sing. They do all kinds of stuff. And I got to thinking about how, you know, like when you and I were growing up, Phillies fans were not known for that kind of enthusiasm. They were known for the other kind, you know, booing, throwing batteries at people, throwing snowballs at Santa Claus, booing Santa Claus, that kind of stuff. And as a Cub fan, I like to relate everything back to the Cubs. I know how it's different for me now that the Cubs actually won. I feel like it's kind of the same thing for Phillies fans, right? They did win in 80, but it had been a long time. And then it was a long time again until they won in 08. And I feel like it's just like the Eagles have won a Super Bowl and been in another Super Bowl. I feel like they're just Phillies fans are in a better place. And now they can just enjoy stuff instead of carrying around the extra baggage of we're not New York. We're the city that's within easy driving range that just gets shit on all the time. And so it's just freed them up to just be happy and excited. And it is even on TV. It's an incredible atmosphere for a game.
I don't think it is the same kind of happy and excited that people in other cities. You know, it's still. There's still a more than a tinge, you know. I think that the chip on the shoulder, and you know, they're not throwing things, but they're still kind of savage in their glee. You know, lots of Schadenfreude, and you know, it's fun if it's not happening to you. You know, I think you know it's intimidating. It's you know, not quite the brute force of before, but you know, they are enjoying themselves because they know their team is good and they have a chance. So it changes their outlook a little bit, but I think they still, you know, deep down harbor that fear that things are going to blow up at any moment. And so, you know, as they are having fun, they're doing so in a way that, you know, I still feel like things could go haywire at any moment and the place could explode in a terrible way. So yes, they still have a little bit of that baggage that they carry around on the inside.
Yeah, the booze can come out at any moment. But until then, they're just going to enjoy themselves. For me, I felt that in, I mean, because you know, Cubs fans forever, we had become accustomed to it's not a matter of if shit is going to go bad, it's when it's going to go bad. And you lived your whole life like that. And after they won the pennant in 16, you know, then they finally come home, they get to play their first three World Series games since 1945, and they lose the first two, and now they're down 3-1, and the Indians can win the World Series at Wrigley Field. And that was prime for a weird, angsty crowd.
Yes.
And the Cub fans didn't do it, even when they fell behind 1-0. It was an oddly, like, excited, supportive crowd. And then when they got the lead, they never gave it back in the World Series. They once Chris Bryant tied the game with a home run, they never trailed in that whole World Series again.
Right.
That crowd doesn't do that if they hadn't watched them win a pennant a week before.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, no matter what happens, we got to a World Series finally. And, you know, I'm not saying if they had lost that World Series, everything goes bad again. You know, then right. It's all back to, holy crap, why can't we win? But at least for one brief. So I feel like I know how the Philly fans feel right now, which is we're just going to really enjoy this until you give us a reason not to. And then.
Yeah, I definitely feel that similarity for sure. I think, you know, we mentioned earlier and how Trey Turner was going bad, and they, you know, did the pivot, and, you know, rather than pile on, they thought, you know, it was a little more thoughtful because, you know, no matter how the fans are going to react to Trey Turner, how long is that contract? Is it, did he sign like a 10-year contract? Is something like that, 8 or 10 years? Maybe not that long. But
no, I guess 10. I guess 10, $330 million.
Right. So he's going to be here for a while.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we – they thought about it, and, you know, if we turn on him, maybe it's even longer until he comes out of this funk. So it's hard to say how much fan action has an impact on how well a guy plays or doesn't play, but I think it helped a little bit. It certainly didn't hurt.
Do we know what prompted
being more thoughtful?
Do we know what prompted that standing ovation? Like,
it was a
Trey Turner Appreciation Day, and they all just decided en masse to do it.
I think it was one of those viral things where I think it started as a prominent fan with some followers on social media who just kind of said, "Hey, you know, everybody expects." I think it might have even gone back to last year when Alec Bohm was having a hard time, and he said, "You know, I effing hate this place." After the fans were ripping him again, sort of like Arcia. I think it was. I'm sure he did. I believe that he meant that. But I think from there, the fans, rather than pile on, that was kind of like the prototype for what happened with Turner. And they tried to be positive with him, and he ended up having a great second half and a good playoffs. And I think that's sort of where it started. And I think it was one person on social media saying, "Hey, let's react differently than the world expects us to, and let's try and be positive for the guy." And you know, even though nobody deserves a standing ovation for what Turner has done so far, let's give it to him and see what happens. So I think it was one of those kind of organic things.
I tried to organize.
A little forced, but organic.
I tried to organize the same kind of thing for Jameson Taillon when he got off to a bad start this year for the Cubs. I tried to get fans to throw canned hams onto the field for him. it didn't catch on. He got one bologna sandwich wrapped in wax paper tossed from the corner of the left field bleachers. That's about all he got. He did eat it.
If you hit people in the front row with a canned ham, though, that's dangerous.
Yeah, you think they crack down on cup snakes. Wait till somebody tries a canned ham snake. Good Lord. Those things are heavy.
And, you know, conversely, you know, we talk about bad reactions. You know, the Braves fans were throwing trash after, I don't even remember what it was, but, you know, it occurred to me, or it occurred to an announcer, you know, you'd think you'd see this in some other cities before you'd see in Atlanta, but the Braves fans a couple years ago did it as well. One or two times they've been famous for trash in the field. I think probably most cities have done kind of that, and that's just always the wrong thing to do no matter what. So
famously in Chicago, it happened on Randy Myers blew a save on Randy Myers poster day, and all the fans threw the posters on the field. And I asked Randy about it, and he said if I had had a poster, I'd have thrown it on the field too. Yeah, it happened. The Braves did it in that wild card game against the Cardinals when the infield fly rule was inappropriately applied. But
if everybody all of a sudden understands that.
Yes, especially in Atlanta. I mean, I don't know. I if you gave an IQ test to that crowd, I don't know how many of them would register. Really surprised you'd have that kind of ugly fan behavior from a fan base that all get together and do a racist chant at odd times during games.
Yeah.
What a shock. So as we sit here, it's always weird to me that they one series will have played two games before the other one gets started.
Right.
And that happened again, where the Rangers were up 2-0 before the National League one even got started. But as we sit here, the Rangers are up 2-0, and the Phillies have a 1-0 lead over the Diamondbacks. The Astros had a losing record at home this year.
Right.
So they're probably just thrilled to get out of Minute Maid and go to Arlington or Dallas or wherever that park is and play. So that series, there's a few things. The Astros didn't play well at home. The Astros easily won the season series against the Astros or against the Rangers.
Yes.
They had a series in the Rangers ballpark where I think they won the 3-game series like 39-8.
Yeah.
So it probably feels like that series is not over at 2 games.
And plus, we've got Max Scherzer coming back, and he is. You never know what you're going to get. We talked about Kershaw being iffy, and Scherzer's kind of at that point too, maybe. So we'll see if he's.
Yeah.
What his 3 or 4 innings is going to be like.
Max Scherzer pitched one of my all-time favorite playoff innings ever. And it was not the one where he came out of the bullpen to beat the 107, to get the save, I guess, over the 107-win Giants a couple of years ago.
Right.
And then by the end of the inning was only throwing like 85 miles an hour and then made a start right. against the Braves and couldn't throw more than 85 miles an hour. And there was he left his arm literally in the bullpen at San Francisco. He left his heart and his arm in the bullpen at San Francisco. It was when in game Game 5 of the 2017 NLDS, when the Nationals got the lead, and Dusty said, all right, we're bringing Max in, and he's going to shut these Cubs down. And the Cubs, I think it's the only inning in big league history, right, where the Cubs reach base every way that it's possible to reach base. They reached on a hit, they reached on a walk, they had a hit batter, they had a catcher's interference, they had everything. And there was Max with his weird two different colored eyes leaving before the inning was over. It was
right.
Because it's one of those things, as a baseball fan, one of the coolest things you see in the postseason is bullpen door swings open and out comes the other team's best pitcher in a spot where he normally doesn't pitch. You saw it all those years, and you saw it most famously when in Kansas City the bullpen door opens up and here comes Madison Bumgarner just ready to shove it up the Royals' ass. And Cubs fans got to live that in 16 when the doors opened and John Lester came out. And here we were a year later, and it's Max. And it didn't work. And
right.
It was Max, and it was Dusty. And it was just great.
That killed the trend.
It did. And then Wade Davis had to pitch like 4 innings, and Jose Quintana had to get it out, and they had to get on the plane, and Jose's wife had a panic attack, and they landed in Albuquerque, and the Cubs dynasty was off the rails. But it was after the Max thing, not before.
Yeah.
We had that moment, at least. Is everybody's like Astros and Rangers, they don't like each other. Is that a real rivalry?
Well, I think it's I'm not as informed on the details, but I think it's, I mean, it has become more of a real rivalry since they came to the same division.
Yeah.
I think before it was maybe more like a Cubs Sox thing where the cities didn't, the fan bases didn't like each other, and big brother, little brother kind of a thing. But since the Rangers have gotten good again, and they're in the same division as the Astros, coming off the, the Astros being so good in the playoffs. I think it's developed into that. So I don't know too many more details about like specific incidents that might have happened in the games the last couple of years that have made it come along. But I think the competitiveness, the authentic competitiveness of the, both teams has, in the same division, has made it more real. Yeah.
They're, the franchises are roughly the same age. The Astros are an expansion team. The Rangers were a de facto expansion team where you let Washington bring the Senators back again, and then you just waited a few years, and then they just moved. Like, Senators 1 went to Minnesota, Senators 2 went to Texas. And I always felt like Texas was always the kind of the little brother in that, mostly because their park didn't have a roof, so it was just a million degrees and mosquitoes as big as cars, and nobody wanted to go to the games. And then, other than Billy Martin running around screaming at everybody, and Whitey Herzog teams trying to steal a million bases with a bunch of bunch of fat, slow white guys, they just didn't have a lot going until they famously blew a World Series against the Cardinals because Nelson Cruz couldn't catch a routine fly ball.
Right.
The Astros are in their seventh consecutive league championship series. And there was all this talk about if they win another one, that'd be three, and then they can be considered a dynasty because there's some kind of artificial checklist that you have to go through for a dynasty. But they don't get the credit that they think they deserve, and objectively they deserve it, because they got caught cheating when they won their first World Series. And they can't get over the fact that people are still mad at them about that. It's like, guys, it was, what you did was, like, everybody tries to cheat. What you guys did was even more, it was so brazen that even other baseball teams went, oh, God.
Yeah.
Whoa, you can't do that. Do you think we'll look back with some hindsight and maybe appreciate just how good this run is? Or do you think that stink will always be on it?
That's a great million-dollar question. I think the intensity of the stink has abated a little bit, but it's always, even in open-minded people such as you and I, it's always in the back of our minds. Even though we're, you just said, they deserve the credit. I'm pretty sure we're wondering, well, are they still cheating? What are they doing now? That's, I don't know. I wondered this about the steroid era, so-called, as if no one's doing steroids now. What people will think of the Sammy Sosa, Mark McGwire, Brady Anderson era, and it still bothers people, and that's 25 years now gone, or 20 years. So no, I don't know, the longer we go, and the if there's no more scandals, maybe, but I think it's always going to kind of be there. And it's all, and you sort of said this too, it's baseball has always had teams that cheated and pushed the envelope, and it's kind of hard to believe that that they won't keep trying to do that. So the next time there's a cheating scandal, no matter what team it is, the old Astros will be brought up. So I don't think it's ever going to die completely, but they make for good villains, I guess, good foils.
Yeah, I mean, the Braves built this run. They started it under a GM who was just falsifying birth certificates of Dominican prospects. And they think they caught them all, but they don't know. He lost his job over it. But the Astros thing, it's not objectively, it's really impressive to have a run this long, considering that really the only guy who's been there through all of it is Altuve. They've replaced everybody else. It's, you know, it's not just we put this one core together and we rode it as long as we could. You know, they have they lost George Springer and they lost Carlos. They didn't lose him. They let him go. Right. They didn't want to pay him. They let him go. And then they, you know, Correa leaves and they plug Jeremy Peña in. And for one postseason, he's amazing. And he's the ALCS and World Series MVP. And so you have to admire the fact that they at least have that, you know, they could plug in that kind of talent. The one that's crazy to me is the fact that they got Yordan Alvarez for Josh Field.
Oof.
And the Dodgers' defense is like, well, he'd never actually played yet.
Right.
Yeah, but you. Yeah, maybe you should have evaluated it before you traded him for a mediocre middle reliever. Right. You traded Big Poppy, you know, 2.0, who might have come in handy.
Yeah, I think he is. I think he is the best hitter in baseball. I think it's just objectively so. It's just impossible to pitch to him.
It's ridiculous.
It's kind of possible to pitch to Judge and some other people. I think this guy's the best hitter. Juan Soto has not really developed into that. It seemed like he was gonna. But Yordan Alvarez is what everybody kind of thought Juan Soto was going to be when he was 19 or 20. So, and he's still doing it.
Yeah, apparently he was sick before game two. They couldn't keep any. They tell you more than you need to know. Couldn't keep food down. Couldn't do whatever. Dusty wasn't going to put him in the lineup. Put him in the lineup because he's DH. He can go lay on the. He can go lay in the clubhouse. It's two home runs.
I think he had Michael Jordan's Utah pizza delivered. Yeah. I think that's what it was.
That's probably what it was. Yeah, you were asking about who's going to remember the, like, what's the feeling about the steroid era now this many years, you know, 25 or whatever years later. And I can tell you that thankfully Tom Ricketts is looking out for the fans by shunning Sammy, because that's clearly what the fans want. Yeah, but even that, there's weird stuff with that. There's the people who are like, it's ridiculous that, and they get greedy. They lump too many guys together. It's ridiculous that Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens and Mark McGwire aren't in the Hall of Fame because they would have been Hall of Famers anyway. And it's like, whoa. Two of those, probably not true. Roger's career had clearly stalled out his last year in Boston.
Right.
And he had like 118 wins. He'd been a great postseason pitcher at times, except when he got a blister in game six. He was going to be in the Hall of very good. And then all of a sudden he went to Toronto and he got in shape, miraculously, and then he was great for like the next, you know, 12 years and easily put up Hall of Fame numbers. McGwire, there's no way that guy's a Hall of Famer if he doesn't turn into, you know, whatever.
Too many injuries. He wasn't on the field enough. It wasn't even a performance. He wasn't compiling enough stats. He wasn't going to be around.
I mean, LaRussa had to bench him 1 year because he was on the final day of the season, so he wouldn't hit under 200. He was batting 201, mm-hmm. and Tony gave him the last day off so he wouldn't go 0 for 4 and hit 199. Yeah, I don't think that's a borderline or a sure thing Hall of Famer. And he had Bonds, who he basically started using out of jealousy.
Right.
He's looking at McGwire. He's looking at McGwire and Sosa, and he's like, "I'm so much better than these two assholes." And look at the ridiculous numbers they put up. Fine, I'll do it too. And then you'll see what happens. And it was amazing. You know, he used steroids out of spite, basically. He should get it just for that. He'd be like, all right, fine. It'd be one guy decided he was going to show us. If he took the best player in baseball and load him up on steroids, what kind of video game numbers would he put up? And he did. So, fine. Barry, you can go in. I don't think that's why Brady Anderson did it.
He did it because his sideburns weren't big enough. He needed bigger sideburns. And the only way he could do that was with steroid shampoo.
And it's funny, too, you know, with the Diamondbacks back in the playoffs again, and they'll go through the, you know, the Diamondbacks all-time record for home runs in a postseason, or whatever it is, and it'll be Luis Gonzalez. And you're like, sure. That shouldn't count. Yeah. I guess we'll begrudgingly admit. Former Cub, Luis Gonzalez. Yeah, he was a great one. So the Diamondbacks, You know, they got down, what was it, 5-0 in game one, and they chipped their way back. They, you know, they look like they, I don't think they're going to be overwhelmed by the Phillies. But what do you think there? Do you think,
Yeah, the Phillies will be away from their loyal fans. Arizona is a weird place, kind of a weird ballpark where weird things happen. Cub fans know this.
Yep.
And the Diamondbacks, you know, they've had a lot of good runs during the season, but, you know, I think you mentioned that we've also kind of counted them out a little bit because they've had some debilitating moments and some streaks that were bad. I think they can probably get back into the series. You know, it's not like the Phillies crushed them too much in the last game, so I think it's possible to we'll see what I mean. It hurt a little bit that they couldn't win the Gallen game,
yeah,
because he's clearly their best pitcher.
Yeah,
but I suppose Captain Stubing Merrill Kelly can get them back into things. So I think that's possible, and I think the Astros getting away from their home ballpark, which is like you said, has been so bad for them, maybe can get them back in the series a little bit. And I still worry about the Rangers bullpen. I'm not sure how much some more we need of Josh Spores.
Yeah.
So they're relying on him for some big outs. So we'll see. We'll see what Max Scherzer can do, if it blows up in his face or not. So I would say don't be surprised if these series go 6 games, yeah, 7 games.
Maybe. Well, that'd be good. That's what you want. I mean, you want, like, you want some drama.
Right.
Yeah, well, the role this, you know, Mr. Setup Man now coming in the eighth and pitching in his personal house of horrors, the Enron Minute Maid Dome, whatever it is. The, you know, the I guess that game was on Fox. So when the ball gets hit with the one where Altuve ended up getting doubled off, the camera kind of pushed back. It didn't follow the ball immediately. It kind of pushed back from home plate. And the look on a roll this stood there like, fuck, I just gave up another home run. And it got caught instead. So, because they were like, well, you know, he's had some terrible moments in this park. Oh, he just had another one. But then he didn't. Yeah, the Rangers are, I mean, that's an interesting team, given that I think people are like, well, you know, they just went out and they spent all that money and they got, and they did. I mean, they spent a lot of money on Corey Seager and on Marcus Semien and whatever. But, you know, that's a team that there's just a lot of really good young, their own guys, like Jonah Heim and Hierarchy of Needs, Josh Jung and Evan Carter.
Josh Jung's made some amazing plays at third base. He booted one. But he made a lot of tough.
Yeah.
He's been, you know, and he can hit home runs. It's pretty exciting young player.
I did. I enjoyed when he made the error. That's loaded the bases, and then Evaldi got out of it. I enjoyed. He, like, looked at his glove as though it had horribly betrayed him.
I love when they do that. Yeah.
He just stared at it like, how did you not catch that?
I thought we were friends.
Yeah, you'll enjoy this. So that set up bases loaded, nobody out. And, an inning later, a Cub blogger tweeted out, I think, as if this was like the deepest thought he'd ever had, I think the Astros might regret not scoring any runs there with the bases loaded and nobody out. Do you think so? Really? Holy shit.
So.
You should write this. You need to write these things down. These are gems.
That's the kind of analysis I used to write for Bally Sports.
Yeah, it was at least that good. At least, it was at least... Your analysis was at least that deep.
Right.
Yeah, so I guess the last thing I want to ask you is, Jeff Francoeur any good?
As a...
analyst. I mean, I don't have to worry about his playing days anymore. He's done striking out 185
I think
times this
he's,
season.
He has a... I think he as a broadcaster, he's actually a lot like he was as a player. There's stuff that happens that makes you scratch your head. And every once in a while, he'll do something. He'll say something insightful. He might be hurt a little bit by the three-man booth. I think they think he, you know, the three-man booth always to me indicates a lack of confidence in the one analyst to say anything. And I think if I think him and Brian Anderson together would be enough. Then again, maybe he would try and say too much and then say silly things too. So I think he has his moments. I always have I have a soft spot for Frank Hoor as a person because he used to like buy fans beer and stuff, and they would send him pizzas. Like in Oakland, that happened when he played for the Royals, and so I always think he means well. Conversely, Smoltz is out to, you know, make us all hate baseball. So I give him the benefit of the doubt. That's my Frank Hoor analysis.
My deep analysis on Jeff Frank Hoor is he has two handicaps. Number one, he spent way too many years working with Chip, and it takes a while. Eventually, the Chip stuff will wear off, but he also has a bad voice.
Yeah,
it's weird. It's not annoying, but it's also like not authoritative.
Right.
And so you just he's super easy to tune out, is what it is. Like yeah. You can watch and you can think back for like you watch an inning and be like, wait, has he said anything? And you know he's been talking.
Right.
But nothing's stuck. Yeah, I mean, I think when, as a viewer, when I'm like, oh, good, Ron Darling's there to help out, that's probably not a great sign. You know, I like Ron. Yeah. There's no reason not to like Ron Darling. But it's not like he's so good that it's like, oh, thank God. You
know? Right.
Now, I mean, if you wanted to have, you wanted to bring Gary Cohen and Keith Hernandez in and let them work with Ron, I would be all for that. I very much enjoy the ridiculous Mets broadcast booth with Keith wandering off and trying not to talk about what he saw on Fox News the night before, but instead talking about his 21-year-old cat, Haji, for tell a 15-minute story about his cat that's old enough to drink. Yeah, and with Smoltz, I just find the Fox booth weird. Like, I think Joe Davis is a good announcer, but he's an announcer who wants to get excited. Right, like he's looking for any reason to get excited, and where some announcers you can't get them to ever yell or do anything, he's way too much to the point where you never know if something exciting is really happening or if Joe has just decided it's time to yell. So you get a lot of that. With Smoltz, what you used to get was, and maybe it's because, how about this? He was more tolerable with Joe Buck, because Buck would occasionally just call him on his shit.
Right.
And be like, really? You know, you're going to be the curmudgeon about this too or whatever?
Yes.
Davis is never going to do that. He's just going to try to, like, overpower him with happiness. But at least you felt like, even though Smoltz was just all, he has a tone where it always sounds like he's bitching, even when he's not.
Right.
He can always make anything sound like a complaint, even if it's not a complaint. He has that gift. But you always felt like he was on top of everything until, I think it was game two, he explained the three-pitcher rule wrong.
Wrong, yes.
Because they brought Spores in, and Smoltz was like, this is a great place to bring him in because he can get the final out here, but because he's finishing the inning, you have the option that if you bring him back that he only has to pitch to one or two batters in the next inning. Like, no, that's not how it works. He can leave now when the inning ends, but if he comes back, he's got to get to three. He's got to pitch to the first two guys, and John clearly explained it as though you now have the option to use him for as many outs as you want. And it's like, that rule is not that new anymore. You should really probably know that one.
And, you know, he's also a guy, and I've complained about this a lot, and he uses these words, you know, people don't understand. I mean, that's what Smoltz says about, you know, whenever he's going to make a great point about something, and then he comes out with this three batter rule and doesn't understand it. So it's just, you know, I hate that attitude. It's not very welcoming. It's like, you know, he's scolding the audience for not being as smart as he is about baseball, and then lots of times he's not that smart.
Well, it's like there's two things about it. Number one, people don't understand. Well, it's too bad you don't have a forum where you could
right.
educate us, on the small right. things about baseball. Maybe without starting the lecture with, all right, morons, here's something you don't know. The other thing is, you're right, it's usually a preface of something completely banal. Like, people don't understand, the reason they put that weight on the bat is that when they bat, the bat feels lighter. Is that what that's for? I thought it was an actual donut, in case they got hungry. They could snack during a pitching change. Oh, well. It gets very jarring as the playoffs move on. Just the inventory that drops off. Like, you get used to, hey, there's four games today. Or, well, there's still three games today.
Right.
Well, today there's two. Today there's one. And then soon there will be the days when there are none.
Right.
And then it's over.
Then we go into
and then it's it. On to every Cub fan's new favorite thing, the offseason, where anything's possible. This offseason much better than the real season, because in the offseason, oh, my God, every prospect is going to be great, and we're going to sign all these guys, we're going to make these trades, and this is going to be great. And then they go to the winter meetings, and they come back with nothing, and then they do – it's yeah. But Cub fans get really excited because the games will end, those pesky, annoying games, and then you're free to just dream about how awesome Jed is going to make your favorite team.
Right.
All right. Well, enjoy the baseball.
You as well.
All right. Thanks
for having me.
Many of us have herpes.